You have to deal with him eventually, Khalifa Lai. Will you do it with India in your bed and by your side, or will you do it while most of your forces have to remain here to keep us from destroying you from behind? Because I'll do it. Either we're lovers or enemies, and the time to choose is now. He made no idle threat to detain her or kill her. He knew that he could no more do that than let her walk out of the compound naked. The real question was whether he would be a grudging husband or an enthusiastic one. He reached out and took her hand. "You've chosen wisely, Khalifa Lai," she said. She leaned down and kissed him, the same kiss she had given Peter Wiggin, and which he had treated as if it were nothing. Alai returned it warmly. His hands moved on her body. "Marriage first," she said. "Let me guess," he said. "You want the wedding now, in this room. Will you dress so we can show the video of the ceremony?" She laughed and kissed his cheek. "For publicity, I'll dress." She started to walk away, but he caught her hand, drew her back, kissed her again, passionately this time. "This is a good idea," he said to her. "It's a bold idea. It's a dangerous idea. But it's a good one." "I'll stand beside you in everything," she said. "Not ahead," he said. "Not behind, not above, not below." She embraced him and kissed his headdress. Then she pulled it off his head and kissed his hair. "Now I'll have to go to all that trouble of putting that back on," he said. "You'll take whatever trouble I want you to take," she thought. "I have just had a victory here today, in this room, Khalifa Lai. You and your Allah may not realize it, but the gods of India rule in this place, and they have given me victory without another soldier dying in useless war." Such fools they were in battle school, to let so few girls in. It left the boys helpless against a woman when they returned to Earth.
Chapter 18. Yerevan. From Petra Delphiki at freepeopleofearth.fp.gov to Dink Meeker at coleman.gov. Ray, can't believe you're at this address. When Bean told me what happened at the meeting, I thought, I know one guy who's never going to go along with any plan of Graf's. Then I got your letter informing me of your change of address, and then I thought some more and realized there's no place on Earth where Dink Meeker is going to fit in. You have too much ability to be content anywhere that they're likely to let you serve. But I think you were wrong to refuse to be the head of the colony you're joining. Partly it's because who's going to do it better than you? Don't make me laugh. But the main reason is, what kind of living hell will it be for the colony leader to have Mr. Insubordinate in his colony? Especially because everybody will know you were in Ender's Jeesh, and they'll wonder why you aren't leader. I don't care how loyal you think you're going to be, Dink. It's not in you. You're a brat, and you always will be. So admit what a lousy follower you are, and go ahead and lead. And just in case you don't know it, you stupidest of all possible geniuses, I still love you. I've always loved you. But no woman in her right mind would ever marry you and have your babies because nobody could stand to raise them. You will have the most hellish children. So have them in a colony where there'll be some place for them to go when they run away from home about 15 times before they're 10. Dink, I'm going to be happy in the long run. And yes, I did set myself up for hard times when I married a man who's going to die and whose children will probably have the same disease. But Dink, nobody ever marries anybody who isn't going to die. God be with you, my friend. Heaven knows the devil already is. Love, Petra.
Bean held two babies and Petra one on the flight from Kiev to Yerevan. Whichever one was hungriest got Mama. Petra's parents lived there now. By the time Ashil died and they could return to Armenia, The tenants in their old home in Maralik had changed it too much for them to want to return. Besides, Stefan, Petra's younger brother, was quite the world traveler now, and Maralik was too small for him. Yerevan, while not what anyone would call one of the great world cities, was still a national capital, and it had a university worth studying at when he graduated from high school. But to Petra, Yerevan was as unfamiliar a city as Volgograd would have been, or any of the cities named San Salvador. Even the Armenian that was still spoken by many on the street sounded strange to her. It made her sad. "I have no native land," she thought. Bean, however, was drinking it all in. Petra got into the cab first, and he handed her Bella and the newest but largest of the babies, Ramon, whom he had picked up in the Philippines. Once Bean was inside the taxi, he held Ender up to the window, and since their firstborn son was beginning to show signs that he understood speech, it wasn't just a matter of playfulness. "This is your mama's homeland," said Bean. "All these people look just like her." Bean turned back to the two that Petra was holding. "You children all look different, because half your genetic material comes from me. And I'm a mongrel. So in your whole life, there'll be no place you can go where you'll look like the locals." "That's right. Depress and isolate the children from the start," said Petra. "It's worked so well for me." "You weren't depressed as a child," said Petra. "You were desperate and terrified. So we try to make things better for our children."
"Look, Bella. Look, Ramon," said Petra.
"This is Yerevan, a city with lots of people that we don't know at all. The whole world is full of strangers." The taxi driver spoke up in Armenian. "Nobody in Yerevan is a stranger to Petra Arkanian. Petra Delphiki," she corrected him mildly. "Yes, yes, of course," he said in common. "I just meaning that if you want a drink in a tavern, nobody let you pay." "Does that go for her husband?" asked Bean. "Man big like you?" said the driver. "They don't tell you the price. They ask you what you wanting to give." He roared with laughter at his own joke, not realizing, of course, that Bean's size was killing him. "Big man like you, little tiny babies like these." He laughed again. Think how amused he'd be if he knew that the largest baby, Ramon, was the youngest. "I knew we should have walked from the airport," said Bean in Portuguese. Petra grimaced.
"That's rude, to speak in a language he doesn't know."
"Ah, I'm glad to know that the concept of rudeness does exist in Armenia." The taxi driver picked up on the mention of Armenia, even though the rest of the sentence, being in Portuguese, was a mystery to him.
"You wanting a tour of Armenia?"
"Not a big country. I can take you. Special price. Meter not running." "No time for that," said Petra in Armenian, "but thanks for offering." The Arkanian family now lived in a nice apartment building, all balconies and glass, yet upscale enough that there was no hanging laundry visible from the street. Petra had told her family she was coming, but asked them not to meet her at the airport. They had gotten so used to the extraordinary security during the days when Petra and Bean were in hiding from Achille Flandre that they accepted this unquestioningly. The doorman recognized Petra from her pictures, which appeared in the Armenian papers whenever there was a story about Bean. He not only let them go up unannounced, but also insisted on carrying their bags.
"You two and three babies, this all the luggage you have?"
"We hardly ever wear clothes," said Petra, as if this were the most sensible thing in the world. They were halfway up in the elevator before the doorman laughed and said,
"You joking?"
Bean smiled and tipped him $100 coin. The doorman flipped it in the air and pocketed it with a smile.
"Good thing he give me. If Petra Arkanian give, my wife never let me spend."
After the elevator doors closed, Bean said, From now on, in Armenia, you tip.
They'd keep the tip either way, Bean. It's not like they give it back to us.
Oh, eh. Petra's mother could have been standing at the door. She opened it so quickly.
Maybe she was.
There were hugs and kisses and a torrent of words in Armenian and common. Unlike the cab driver and doorman, Petra's parents were fluent in common. So was Stefan, who had cut his high school classes today. And young David was obviously being raised with common as his first language, since that's what he was chattering in almost continuously from the moment Petra entered the flat. There was a meal, of course, and neighbors invited in, because it might be the big city, but it was still Armenia. But in only a couple of hours, it was just the nine of them.
Nine of us, said Petra. Our five and the four of you. I've missed you.
Already you have as many children as we did, said Father.
The laws have changed, said Bean. Also, we didn't exactly plan to have ours all at once.
Sometimes I think, said Mother to Petra, that you're still in battle school.
I have to remind myself, no, she came home. She got married. She has babies. Now we finally get to see the babies.
But so small.
They have a genetic condition, said Bean.
Of course we know that, said Father.
But it's still a surprise how small they are, and yet so mature.
The really little ones take after their father, said Petra, with a wry smile.
And the normal one takes after his mother, said Bean. Thank you for letting us use your flat for the unofficial meeting tonight.
It's not a secure site, said Father.
The meeting is unofficial, not secret. We expect Turkish and Azerbaijani observers to make their reports.
Are you sure they won't try to assassinate you? Asked Stefan.
Actually, Stefan, they brainwashed you at an early age, said Bean. When the trigger word is said, you spring into action and kill everybody at the meeting.
No, I'm going to a movie, said Stefan.
That's a terrible thing to say, said Petra, even as a joke.
A lie isn't a shield, said Bean to Stefan. We're friends, and he won't let Muslim agents assassinate us.
You're friends with your enemy? Said Stefan, as if it were too incredible.
It happens in some wars, said Father.
There is no war yet, Mother reminded them. They took the hint, stopped talking about current problems, and reminisced instead.
Though since Petra had been sent to battle school so young, it's not as if she had that much to reminisce about.
It was more like they were briefing her about her new identity before an undercover mission. This is what you should remember from your childhood, if you'd had one.
And then the Prime Minister, the President, and the Foreign Minister showed up. Mother took the babies into her bedroom, while Stefan took David out to see a movie. Father, being Deputy Foreign Minister, was allowed to stay, though he would not speak. The conversation was complex, but friendly. The Foreign Minister explained how eager Armenia was to join the FPE, and then the President echoed everything he had said, and then the Prime Minister began another repetition. Bean held up a hand. Let's stop hiding from the truth. Armenia is a landlocked country, with Turks and Azerbaijanis almost completely surrounding you. With Georgia refusing to join the FPE at present, you worry that we couldn't even supply you, let alone defend you against the inevitable attack. They were obviously relieved that Bean understood. You just want to be left alone, he said. They nodded. But here's the truth. If we don't defeat Caliph Alai and break up this strange and sudden union of Muslim nations, then Caliph Alai will eventually conquer all the surrounding nations. Not because Alai himself wants to, but because he can't remain Caliph for long if he isn't aggressively pursuing an expansionist policy. He says that's not his intent, but he'll certainly end up doing it because he'll have no choice. They didn't like hearing this, but they kept listening. Armenia will fight Caliph Alai sooner or later. The question is whether you'll do it now, while I still lead the forces of the FPE in your defense, or later, when you stand utterly alone against overwhelming force.
Either way, Armenia will pay, said the president grimly.
War is unpredictable, said Bean, and the costs are high. But we didn't put Armenia where it is, surrounded by Muslims.
God did, said the president.
So we try not to complain.
Why can't Israel be your provocation? Asked the prime minister.
They are militarily much stronger than we are.
The opposite is true, said Bean. Geographically, their position is and always has been hopeless, and they have integrated so closely with the Muslim nations surrounding them that if they now joined the FPE, the Muslims would feel deeply betrayed. Their fury would be terrible, and we could not defend them. While you, let's just say that over the centuries, Muslims have slaughtered more Armenians than they ever did Jews. They hate you. They regard you as a terrible intrusion into their lands, even though you were here long before any Turks came out of Central Asia. There's a burden of guilt along with the hatred. And for you to join the FPE would infuriate them. Yes, but they wouldn't feel betrayed.
These nuances are beyond me, said the president skeptically.
They make an enormous difference in the way an army fights. Armenia is vital to forcing Alai to act before he's ready. Right now the union with India is still merely formal, not a fact on the ground. It's a marriage, not a family.
You don't need to quote Lincoln to me.
Petra inwardly winced. The quote about a marriage, not a family, did not come from Lincoln at all. It came from one of her own Martel essays. It was a bad sign if people were getting Lincoln and Martel confused. But of course it was better not to correct the misattribution, lest it appear that she was way too familiar with the works of Martel and Lincoln.
We stand where we've stood for weeks, said the president. Armenia is being asked too much.
I agree, said Bean. But keep in mind that we're asking. When the Muslims finally decide that Armenia shouldn't exist, they won't ask. The president pressed his fingers to his forehead. It was a gesture that Petra called drilling for brains.
How can we hold a plebiscite? He asked.
It's precisely the plebiscite that we need.
Why? What does this do for you militarily, except overextend your forces and draw off a relatively small part of the Caliph's armies?
I know a lie, said Bean. He won't want to attack Armenia. The terrain here is a nightmare for serious campaigning. You constitute no serious threat. Attacking Armenia makes no sense at all.
So we won't be attacked?
You will absolutely be attacked.
You're too subtle for us, said the prime minister.
Petra smiled. My husband is not subtle. The point is so obvious that you think it couldn't be this that he means. Alai will not attack, but Muslims will attack. It will force his hand. If he refuses to attack, but other Muslims do attack, then the leadership of the jihad moves away from him to someone else. Whether he strikes down these freelance attackers or not, the Muslim world is divided and two leaders compete.
The president was no fool. You have higher hopes than this, he said.
All warriors are filled with hope, said Bean. But I understand your lack of trust in me. For me, it's the great game. But for you, it's your homes, your families. That's why we wanted to meet here, to assure you that it is our home and our family as well. To sit and wait for the enemy to act is the decision to die, said Petra. We ask Armenia to make this sacrifice and take this risk because if you don't, then Armenia is doomed. But if you join the free people of Earth, then Armenia will have the most powerful defense.
And what will that defense consist of? Me, said Petra.
A nursing mother? Asked the Prime Minister.
The Armenian member of Ender's Jish, she answered.
I will command the Armenian forces.
Our mountain goddess versus the goddess of India, said the foreign minister.
This is a Christian nation, said Father, and my daughter is no goddess.
I was joking, said Father's boss. But the truth that underlies the joke, said Bean, is that Petra herself is a match for Alai. So am I.
And Verlomi is no match for any of us.
Petra hoped that this was true. Verlomi now had years of experience in the field. If not in the logistics of moving huge armies, then in exactly the kind of small operations that would be most effective in Armenia.
We have to think about it, said the president.
Then we're where we were before, said the foreign minister. Thinking.
Bean rose to his feet, a formidable sight these days, and bowed to them.
Thank you for meeting with us.
Wouldn't it be better, said the Prime Minister, if you could get this new Hindu-Muslim thing to go to war against China?
Oh, that would eventually happen, said Bean.
But when?
The FPE wants to break the back of Caliph Alai's Muslim League now, before it grows any stronger.
And Petra knew they were all thinking, before Bean dies, because Bean is the most important weapon. The president rose from his seat, but then laid a restraining hand on the other two.
We have Petra Arkanian here, and Julian Delfiki. Couldn't we ask them to consult with our military on our preparations for war?
I notice there are no military men here, said Petra. I don't want them to feel that we've been thrust on them.
They won't feel that way, said the foreign minister blandly.
But Petra knew that the military was not represented here because they were eager to join the FPE, precisely because they did not feel adequate, by themselves, to defend Armenia. There would be no problems with a tour of inspection. After the top leadership of Armenia left the Arkanian flat, Father and Petra flung themselves down on the furniture, and Bean stretched out on the floor, and at once began discussing what had just happened, and what they thought would happen. Mother came in as the conversation was winding down.
All asleep, the little darlings, she said. Stefan will drop David off after the movie, but we have a little while, just us grown-ups.
Well, good, said Father.
We were just discussing, said Petra, whether it was a waste of time for us to come here.
Mother rolled her eyes.
How can it be a waste of time?
And then, to everyone's surprise, she burst into tears.
What is it?
At once she was enveloped in the concern of her husband and daughter.
Nothing, she said. I just... You didn't come here and bring these babies because you had negotiations. Nothing happened here that couldn't have happened by teleconference.
Then why do you think we're here? Asked Petra.
You came to say goodbye.
Petra looked at Bean, and for the first time realized that this might be true.
If we are, she said, it wasn't our plan.
But it's what you're doing, said Mother. You came in person because you might not see us again. Because of the war.
No, said Bean, not because of the war.
Mother, you know Bean's condition.
I'm not blind. I can see that he's giraffed up so he can hardly get into houses.
And so are Ender and Bella. They have Bean's same condition. So once we get all our other children, we're going out into space, at light speed, so we can take advantage of relativistic effects, so that Bean will be alive when they finally find a cure.
Father shook his head.
Then we'll be dead before you come home, said Mother.
Pretend I'm away at battle school again, said Petra.
I get these grandchildren, but Then I don't get them.
Mother cried again.
I won't leave, said Bean, until we've got Peter Wiggin safely in control of things.
Which is why you're in such a hurry to get this war started, said Father. Why not just tell them?
We need them to have confidence in me, said Bean. Telling them that I might die in mid-campaign won't reassure them about joining the FPE.
So these babies will grow up on a starship? Asked Mother, skeptically.
Our joy, said Petra, will be to see them grow old, without any of them growing as big as their father.
Bean raised one enormous foot.
These are tough shoes to fill.
And it's really true, said Petra, that this war in Armenia is the one we want to fight. All these hills, it will go slowly.
Slowly? Asked Father. Isn't that the opposite of what you want?
What we want, said Bean, is for the war to end as soon as possible. But this is one case where going slow will speed us up.
You're the brilliant strategists, said Father, heading for the kitchen. Anybody else want something to eat?
That night, Petra couldn't sleep. She went out onto the balcony and looked out over the city. Is there anything in this world that I can't leave? I've lived apart from my family for so much of my life. Does that mean I'll miss them more or less? But then she realized that this had nothing to do with her melancholy. She couldn't sleep because she knew that war was coming. Their plan was to keep the conflict in the mountains, to make the Turks pay for every meter. But there was no reason to think that Allies forces, or whatever Muslim forces they were, would shrink from bombing the big population centers. Precision bombing had been the rule for so long, ever since Mecca was nuked, that a sudden reversion to anti-population, saturation bombing would come as a demoralizing shock. Everything depends on our being able to get and keep control of the air. And the FPE doesn't have as many planes as the Muslim League.
Damn those short-sighted Israelis for training the Arab air forces to be among the most formidable in the world.
Why was Bean so confident? Was it only because he knew that he'd soon leave Earth and wouldn't have to be here to face the consequences?
That was unfair.
Bean had said he'd stay until Peter was hegemon, in fact, as well as name. Bean did not break his word. What if they never find a cure? What if we sail on through space forever? What if Bean dies out there with me and the babies? She heard footsteps behind her. She assumed it would be Bean, but it was her mother.
Awake, without the babies waking you?
Petra smiled.
I have plenty to keep me from sleeping. But you need your sleep. Eventually, my body takes it whether I like it or not.
Mother looked out over the city.
Did you miss us?
She knew her mother wanted her to say, every day. But the truth would have to do. When I have time to think about anything at all, yes. But it's not that I miss you. It's that I'm glad you're in my life. Glad you're in this world. She turned to face her mother. I'm not a little girl anymore. I know I'm still very young, and I'm sure I don't know anything yet, but I'm part of the cycle of life now. I'm no longer the youngest generation. So I don't cling to my parents as I once would have liked to. I missed a lot up there in battle school. Children need families.
And, said Mother sadly, they make families out of whatever they have at hand.
That will never happen to my children, said Petra. The world isn't being invaded by aliens. I can stay with them. Then she remembered that some people would claim that some of her children were the alien invasion. She couldn't think that way.
You carry so much weight in your heart, said Mother, stroking her hair.
Not as much as Bean.
Far less than Peter.
Is this Peter Wiggin a good man?
Petra shrugged. Are great men ever really good? I know they can be, but we judge them by a different standard. Greatness changes them, whatever they were to start with. It's like war. Does any war ever settle anything? But we can't judge that way. The test of war isn't whether it's solved things. You have to ask, was fighting the war better than not fighting it? And I guess the same kind of test ought to be used on great men. If Peter Wiggin is great.
Mother, he was Locke, remember? He stopped a war. Already he was great before I came home from battle school. And he was still in his teens. Younger than I am now.
Then I asked the wrong question, said Mother. Is a world that he rules over going to be a good place to live?
Petra shrugged again.
I believe he means it to be. I haven't seen him being vindictive or corrupt. He's making sure that any nation that joins the FPE does it through the vote of the people, so nothing is being forced on them. That's promising, isn't it?
Armenia spent so many centuries yearning to have our own nation. Now we have it, but it seems the price of keeping it is to give it up.
Armenia will still be Armenia, Mother.
No, it won't, she said. If Peter Wiggin wins everything he's trying to win, then Armenia will be Kansas.
Hardly.
We'll all speak common. And if you go from Yerevan to Rostov or Ankara or Sofia, you won't even know you've gone anywhere.
We all speak common now. And there'll never be a time you can't tell Ankara from Yerevan.
You're so sure.
I'm sure of a lot of things, and about half the time I'm right.
She grinned at her mother, but her mother's return smile wasn't real.
How did you do it? Asked Petra. How did you give up your child?
You weren't given up, said Mother. You were taken. Most of the time I managed to believe it was all for a good cause. The other times, I cried. It wasn't death because you were still alive. I was proud of you. I missed you. You were good company almost from your first word. But so ambitious.
Petra smiled a little at that.
You're married now, said Mother. Ambition for yourself is over. It's now ambition for your children.
I just want them to be happy.
That is something you can't do for them. So don't set that as your goal.
I don't have a goal, Mother.
That's nice. Then your heart will never break.
Mother looked at her with a deadpan expression. Petra laughed a little.
You know, when I've been away for a while, I forget that you know everything.
Mother smiled.
Petra, I can't save you from anything. But I want to. I would if I could. Does that help? To know that somebody wants you to be happy?
More than you know, Mother.
She nodded. Tears slipped down her cheeks.
Going off into space. It feels like closing yourself in your own coffin. I know, but that's how it feels to me. I just know that I'm going to lose you. As sure as death.
You know it too. That's why you're out here, saying goodbye to Yerevan.
To Earth, Mother. Yerevan's the least of it.
Well, Yerevan won't miss you. Cities never do. They go on and we don't make any difference to them at all. That's what I hate about cities.
And that's true of the human race too, thought Petra.
I think it's a good thing,
that life goes on, like water in a pail. Take some out, the rest fills in.
When it's my child that's gone, nothing fills in, said Mother.
Petra knew that Mother was referring to the years that she spent without Petra. But what flashed into Petra's mind was the six babies they still hadn't found. The two ideas put together made the loss of those babies, if they even existed, too painful to contain. Petra started to cry. She hated crying. Her mother put her arms around her.
I'm sorry, Pet, she said. I wasn't even thinking. I was missing one child, and you have so many, and you don't even know whether they're alive or dead. But they aren't even real to me, said Petra. I don't know why I'm crying. I've never even met them. We're hungry for our children, said Mother. We need to take care of them once we bring them into existence.
I didn't even get to do that, said Petra. Other women got to bear all but the one, and I'm going to lose him.
And suddenly her life felt so terrible it could not be borne. She sobbed as her mother held her.
Oh, my poor girl, her mother kept murmuring. Your life breaks my heart. How can I complain like this? Said Petra, her voice high with crying. I've been part of some of the greatest events in history.
When your babies need you, history doesn't bring much comfort.
And as if on cue, there was a faint sound of a baby crying inside the flat. Mother made as if to go, but Petra stopped her.
Bean will get her.
She used the hem of her shirt to dab at her eyes.
You can tell from the crying which baby it is.
Couldn't you?
I never had two infants at the same time, let alone three. There aren't many multiple births in our family.
Well, I found the perfect way to have nonuplets. Get eight other women to help.
She managed a feeble laugh at her own black humor. The baby cried again.
It's definitely Bella. She's always more insistent. Bean will change her and then he'll bring her to me.
I could do that and he could go back to sleep,
Mother offered.
It's some of our best time together, said Petra, caring for the babies.
Mother pecked her on the cheek.
I can take a hint.
Thanks for talking to me, Mother.
Thanks for coming home.
Mother went inside. Petra stood at the edge of the balcony. After a while, Bean came padding out in bare feet. Petra pulled her t-shirt up and Bella started slurping noisily. Good thing your brother Ender got my milk factory started, said Petra, or it would have been the bottle for you. As she stood there, nursing Bella and looking out over the nighttime city, Bean's huge hands held her shoulders and stroked her arms. So gentle. So kind. Once as tiny as this little girl, but always a giant, long before his body showed it.
Chapter 19. Enemies. From Note to Hegemon, You Can't Fight an Epidemic with a Fence, by Martell. Posted on Early Warning Network. The presence of Julian Delphiki, the hegemon's enforcer in Armenia, might look like a family vacation to some, but some of us remember that Delphiki was in Rwanda before it ratified the FBE constitution. When you consider that Delphiki's wife, Petra Arkanian, also one of Ender's Jish, is Armenian, what conclusion can be reached except that Armenia, a Christian enclave nearly surrounded by Muslim nations, is preparing to ratify? Add to that the close ties between the hegemon and Thailand, where Wigan's left-hand man, General Surayawong, is now consulting with General Phet Noi and Prime Minister Parabatra, newly returned from Chinese captivity, and the FPE's position in Nubia. And it looks like the hegemon is surrounding Caliph Alai's little empire. Many pundits are saying that the hegemon's strategy is to contain Caliph Alai. But now that the Hindus have gone over to the Muslim bed, I meant to say camp, containment is not enough. When Caliph Alai, our modern Tamerlane, decides he wants a nice big pile of human skulls, it's so hard to get good decorators these days. He can field huge armies and concentrate them wherever he wants on his borders. If the hegemon sits passively waiting, trying to contain Alai behind a fence of alliances, then he'll find himself facing overwhelming force wherever Alai decides to strike. Islam, the bloodthirsty one-way religion, has a track record only slightly less devastating to the human race than the buggers. It's time for the hegemon to live up to his job title and take decisive preemptive action, preferably in Armenia, where his forces will be able to strike like a knife into the neck of Islam. And when he does, it's time for Europe, China, and America to wake up and join him. We need unity against this threat as surely as we ever needed it against an alien invasion. From Peter Wigan, personal at freepeopleofearth.fp.gov, to Petra Delphiki, get lost at freepeopleofearth.fp.gov. Ray, latest Martell essay. Encrypted using code. Decrypted using code. Strike like a knife into the neck of Islam indeed. Using what enormous army? What vast air force to neutralize the Muslims and airlift that enormous army over the mountainous terrain between Armenia and the neck of Islam? Fortunately, while Alai and Verlomi will know that Martell is full of Kuso, the Muslim press is famous for its paranoia. They should believe there's a threat. So now the pressure is on and the game's afoot. You're a natural rabble-rouser, Petra. Promise me you'll never run against me for anything. Oh, wait. I'm hegemon for life, aren't I? Good work, Mommy.
Caliph Alai and Virlomi sat beside each other at the head of a conference table in Chichlam, which the Muslim press still called Hyderabad. Alai couldn't understand why it bothered Virlomi that he refused to insist that the Muslims call the city by its pre-Muslim name. He had problems enough to worry about without a needlessly humiliating name change. After all, the Indians hadn't won their independence. They had married their way to self-government, which was a far better method than war. But without having won a victory on the field of battle, it was unseemly for Virlomi to insist on tokens of triumph, like making your undefeated conquerors change the name they used to refer to their own seat of government. In the past few days, Alai and Virlomi had met with several groups. At a conference of heads of Muslim states, they had listened to the woes and suggestions of such widely separated peoples as Indonesians, Algerians, Kazakhs, and Yemenis. At a much quieter conference of Muslim minorities, they had indulged the revolutionary fantasies of Filipino, French, Spanish, and Thai would-be jihadists. And in between, they had put on banquets for, and listened to stern counsel from, the French, American, and Russian foreign ministers. These lords of the ancient, weary empires, hadn't they noticed that their nations long since retired from the world? Yes, the Russians and Americans still had a formidable military, but where was their will to empire? They thought they could still boss around people like Alai, who had power and knew how to use it. But it did Caliph Alai no harm to pretend that these nations still mattered in the world, placate them with wise nods and palliative words, and they would go home and feel good about having helped promote peace on earth. Alai had complained to Virlomi afterward, Wasn't it enough for the Americans that the whole world used their dollar and let them dominate the IF? Wasn't it enough for the Russians that Caliph Ali was keeping his armies away from their frontier and was doing nothing to support Muslim rebel groups inside their borders? And the French? What did they expect Ali to do when he heard what their government's opinion was? Didn't they understand that they were spectators now in the great game, by their own choice? The players were not going to let the fans call the plays, no matter how well they played back in their day. Virlomi listened benignly and said nothing in all these meetings. Most of the visitors came away with the impression that she was a figurehead, and Caliph Ali was in complete control. This impression did no harm, but as Ali and his closest advisors knew, it was also completely false. Today's meeting was far more important. Gathered at this table were the men who actually ran the Muslim Empire, the men Ali trusted, who made sure that the heads of the various Muslim states did what Ali needed them to do without chafing at how thoroughly they were under the Caliph's thumb. Since Ali had the ecstatic support of most of the Muslim people, he had enormous leverage in gaining the cooperation of their governments. But Ali did not yet have the clout to set up an independent system of finance. So he was dependent on contributions from the various republics and kingdoms and Islamic states that served him. The men at this table made sure that the money flowed inward toward Hyderabad, and obedience flowed outward, with the least possible friction. The most remarkable thing about these men was that they were no richer now than they had been when he appointed them. Despite all their opportunities to take a bribe here or exact a bit of kickback there, they had remained pure. They were motivated by devotion to the Caliph's cause and pride in their positions of trust and honor. Instead of one wazir, Ali had a dozen. They were gathered at this table to counsel him and hear his decisions. And every single one of them resented Virlomi's presence at the table. And Virlomi did nothing to help alleviate this, because even though she spoke softly and briefly, she persisted in using the quiet voice and enigmatic attitude that had played so well among Hindus. But Muslims had no goddess tradition, except perhaps in Indonesia and Malaysia, where they were especially alert to stamp out such tendencies where they found them. Virlomi was like an alien being among them. There were no cameras here. The role wasn't working for this audience, so why did she persist in acting the goddess here? Was it possible she believed it? That after years of playing the part in order to keep Indian resistance alive, she now believed that she was divinely inspired? Ridiculous to think she actually believed she was divine herself. If the Muslim people ever believed she thought that, they would expect Ali to divorce her and have done with this nonsense. They accepted the idea that the Caliph, like Solomon of old, might marry women from many kingdoms in order to symbolize the submission of those kingdoms to Islam as a wife submits to a husband. She couldn't believe she was a goddess. Ali was sure of that. Such superstitions would have been stamped out in battle school. Then again, battle school was over years ago, and Virlomi had lived in isolation and adulation during most of that time. Things had happened that would change anybody. She had told him about the campaign of stones in the road, the Great Wall of India, how she had seen her own actions turn into a vast movement, about how she first became a holy woman and then a goddess in hiding in eastern India. When she taught him about Satyagraha, he thought he understood. You sacrifice anything and everything in order to stand for what's right without causing harm to another. And yet she had also killed men with a gun she held in her own hand. There were times when she did not shrink from war. When she told him of her band of warriors who had stood off the whole Chinese army, preventing them from flooding back into India, from even resupplying the armies that Ali's Persians and Pakistanis were systematically destroying, he realized how much he owed to her brilliance as a commander, as a leader who could inspire incredible acts of bravery from her soldiers, as a teacher who could train peasants to be brutally efficient soldiers. Somewhere between Satyagraha and slaughter, there had to be a place where Virlomi, the girl from battle school, actually lived. Or perhaps not. Perhaps the cruel contradictions of her own actions had led her to put the responsibility elsewhere. She served the gods. She was a god herself. Therefore, it was not wrong for her to live by Satyagraha one day and wipe out an entire convoy in a landslide the next. The irony was that the longer he lived with her, the more Alai loved her. She was a sweet and generous lover, and she talked with him openly, girlishly, as if they were friends in school, as if they were still children. Which we are, aren't we? No, Alai was a man now, despite being in his teens, and Virlomi was older than he was, not a child at all. But they had had no childhood. Alone together, their marriage was more like playing at being husband and wife than anything else. It was still fun. And when they came to a meeting like this, Virlomi could switch off that playfulness, set aside the natural girl, and become the irritating Hindu goddess that continued to drive a wedge between Caliph Alai and his most trusted servants. Naturally, the council was worried about Peter Wiggin and Bean and Petra and Suryawang. That Martell essay was taken very seriously. So, naturally, in order to be irritating, Virlomi dismissed it. Martell can write what he wants. It means nothing. Careful not to contradict her, Hadrubet Sassar, Thorn, pointed out the obvious. The Delphikis really are in Armenia, and have been for a week. They have family there, said Virlomi. And they're on vacation taking the babies to visit grandfather and grandmother, said Alamandar. As usual, his irony was so dry you could easily miss the fact that he was utterly scornful of the idea. Of course not, said Virlomi, and her scorn was not subtle. Wiggin wants us to think they're planning something. We withdraw Turkish troops from Xinjiang to invade Armenia. Then Hanzu strikes in Xinjiang. Perhaps Al-Khalif has some intelligence indicating that the Emperor of China is in alliance with the hegemon, said Thorn. Peter Wiggin, said Virlomi, knows how to use people who don't know they're being used. Alai listened to her and thought, that principle might as easily apply to the Armenians as to Hansa. Perhaps they're being used by Peter Wiggin without their consent. A simple matter to send Bean and Petra to visit the Arcanians, and then plant a false story that this means the Armenians are about to join the FPE. Alai raised a hand. Najas, would you compare the language in the Martell essays with the writings of Peter Wiggin, including the Locke essays, and tell me if they might be written by the same hand? A murmur of approval around the table. We will not take action against Armenia, said Caliph Alai, based on unsubstantiated rumors from the nets, nor based on our long-standing suspicion of the Armenians. Alai watched their reaction. Some nodded approvingly, but most hid their reactions. And Musafi, the youngest of his wazirs, showed his skepticism. Musafi, speak to us, said Alai. It makes little difference to the people, said Musafi, whether we can prove that the Armenians are plotting against us or not. This isn't a court of law. They are being told by many that instead of gaining India peacefully by marriage, we lost it the same way. Alai did not look at Virlomi, nor did he sense any stiffening or change in her attitude. We did nothing when the hegemon humiliated the Sudanese and stole Muslim land in Nubia. Musafi raised his hand to the inevitable objection. The people believe the land was stolen. So you fear that they will think the Caliph is ineffective? They expected you to spread Islam throughout the world. Instead, you seem to be losing ground. The very fact that Armenia cannot be the source of a serious invasion also means that it's a safe place to take some limited action that will assure the people that the Caliphate is still watching over Islam. And how many men should die for this? Said Alai. For the continued unity of the Muslim people? Asked Musafi. As many as love God. There's wisdom in this, said Ali. But the Muslim people are not the only people in the world. Outside of Islam, Armenia is perceived as a heroic victim nation. Isn't there a chance that any kind of action in Armenia will be seen as proof that Islam is expanding, just as Martel charges? Then what happens to the Muslim minorities in Europe? Virlomi leaned forward, looking each of the counselors boldly in the face, as if she had authority at this table. Her stance was more aggressive than Ali ever showed to his friends, but then these were not her friends. You care about unity? It's always been a problem in the Muslim world, said Alamandar. Some of the men chuckled. The free people can't invade us because we're more powerful than they are at any point where they might attack, said Virlomi. Is our goal to unite the world under the leadership of Caliph Ali? Then our great rival is not Peter Wiggin. It's Hanzu. He came to me with plots against Caliph Ali. He proposed marriage with me so India and China could unite against Islam. When was this? Asked Musafi. Ali understood why he was asking. It was before Virlomi and I even considered marriage, Musafi. My wife has behaved with perfect propriety. Musafi was satisfied. Virlomi showed no sign that she even cared what the interruption had been about. You don't fight wars to enhance domestic unity. To do that, you pursue economic policies that make your people fat and rich. Wars are fought to create safety, to expand borders, and to eliminate future dangers. Hanzu is such a danger. Since he has taken office, said Thorne, Hanzu has taken no aggressive action. He has been conciliatory with all his neighbors. He even sent home the Indian Prime Minister, didn't he? That was no conciliatory gesture, said Virlomi. The expansionist Snow Tiger is gone. His policies failed. We have nothing to fear from China, said Thorne. He had gone too far, and everyone at the table knew it. It was one thing to make suggestions, and quite another to flatly contradict Virlomi. Pointedly, Virlomi sat back and looked at Ali, waiting for him to take action against the offender. But Thorne had earned his nickname because he would say uncomfortable truths. Nor did Ali intend to start banishing advisers from his council just because Virlomi was annoyed with them. Once again, our friend Thorne proves that his name is well chosen, and once again, we forgive him for his bluntness, or should I say, sharpness. Laughter. But they were still wary of Virlomi's wrath. I see that this council prefers to send Muslims to die in cosmetic wars, while the real enemy is allowed to gather strength unmolested, solely because he has not attacked us yet. She turned directly to Thorne. My husband's good friend Thorne is like the man in a leaky boat, surrounded by sharks. He has a rifle, and his fellow passenger says, Why don't you shoot those sharks? Once the boat sinks and we're in the water, you won't be able to use the rifle. You fool, says the man. Why should I provoke the sharks? None of them has bit me yet. Thorne seemed determined to press his luck. The way I heard the story, the boat was surrounded by dolphins, and the man shot at them until he ran out of ammunition. Why did you do that? His friend asked, and the man said, Because one of them was a shark in disguise. Which one? Said his companion. You fool, says the man. I told you he's in disguise. Then the blood in the water drew many sharks, but the man's gun was empty. Thank you all for your wise counsel, said Ali. I must now think about all that you have said. Virlomi smiled at Thorne. I must remember your alternate version of the story. It's hard to decide which one is funnier. Maybe one is funny to Hindus, and the other to Muslims. Ali stood up and began shaking hands with the men around the table, in effect dismissing each one in turn. It had already been rude for Verlomi to continue the conversation, but still she would not let up. "Or perhaps," she said to the group as a whole, "Thorn's story is funny only to the sharks, because if his story is believed, the sharks are safe." Verlomi had never gone this far before. If she were a Muslim wife, he could take her by the arm and gently lead her from the room, then explain to her why she could not say such things to men who were not free to answer. But then, if she were a Muslim wife, she wouldn't have been at the table in the first place. Ali shook hands with the rest of them, and they showed their deference to him. But he also saw a growing wariness. His failure to stop Verlomi from giving such outrageous offense to a man who had admittedly gone too far himself looked like weakness to them. He knew they were wondering just how much influence Verlomi had over him, and whether he was truly functioning as caliph anymore, or was just a henpecked husband married to a woman who thought she was a god. In short, was Caliph Ali succumbing to idolatry by being married to this mad woman? Not that anyone could say such a thing, even to each other, even in private. In fact, they probably weren't thinking it either. I'm thinking it. When he and Verlomi were alone, Ali walked out of the room to the conference room toilet, where he washed his face and hands. Verlomi followed him inside. "Are you strong or weak?" she asked. "I married you for your strength." He said nothing. "You know I'm right. Peter Wiggin can't touch us. Only Hanzu stands between us and uniting the world under our rule." "That's not true, Verlomi," said Ali. "So you contradict me, too?" "We're equals, Verlomi," said Ali. "We can contradict each other when we're alone together."
"So if I'm wrong, who is a greater threat than Hanzu?"
"If we attack Hanzu unprovoked, and it looks as if he might lose, or he does lose, then we can expect the Muslim population of Europe to be expelled, and the nations of Europe will unite, probably with the United States, probably with Russia. Instead of a mountain border that Hanzu is not threatening, we'll have an indefensible border thousands of kilometers long in Siberia, and enemies whose combined military might will dwarf ours. America, Europe, those fat old men." "I see you're giving my ideas careful consideration," said Ali. "Nothing's certain in war," said Verlomi. "This might happen, that might happen. I'll tell you what will happen. India will take action, whether the Muslims join us or not. India, which has little equipment and no trained army, will take on China's battle-hardened veterans, and, without the help of the Turkish divisions in Xinjiang and the Indonesian divisions in Taiwan, the Indian people do what I ask them," said Verlomi. "The Indian people do what you ask them, as long as it's possible." "Who are you to say what's possible?" "Verlomi," said Ali, "I'm not Alexander of Macedonia. That much is abundantly clear. In fact, Ali, what battle have you ever fought and won? You mean before or after the final war against the buggers?"
"Of course. You were one of the sacred Jish. So you're right about everything, forever. And it was my plan that destroyed the Chinese will to fight. Your plan, which depended on my little band of patriots holding the Chinese army at bay in the mountains of eastern India. No, Verlomi. Your holding action saved thousands of lives. But if every single Chinese they sent over the mountain had faced us in India, we would have won. Easy to say. Because my plan was for the Turkish troops to take Beijing, while most of the Chinese forces were tied up in India, at which point the Chinese troops would have been called back from India. Your heroic action saved many lives and made our victory quicker, by about 2 weeks and an estimated 100,000 casualties, so I'm grateful. But you've never led large armies into combat." Verlomi waved it away, as if such a gesture could make the fact of it disappear. "Verlomi," said Ali,
I love you, and I'm not trying to hurt you. But you've been fighting all this time against very bad commanders. You've never come up against someone like me, or Hanzu, or Petra, and definitely not one like Bean. The stars of battle school, said Virlomi. Ancient test scores and membership in a club whose president got outmaneuvered and sent into exile. What have you done lately, Caliph Alai? I married a woman with a bold plan, said Alai. But what did I marry, said Virlomi? A man who wants the world to be united in peace. I thought the woman who built the Great Wall of India would want the same thing. I thought our marriage was part of that. I never knew you were so bloodthirsty. Not bloodthirsty. Realistic. I see our true enemy, and I'm going to fight him. Our rival is Peter Wiggin, said Alai. He has a plan for uniting the world, but his depends on the caliphate collapsing into chaos and Islam ceasing to be a force in the world. That's what the Martel essay was designed to do. Provoke us into doing something stupid in Armenia or Nubia. Well, at least you see through that. I see through all of it, said Alai. And you don't see the most obvious thing of all. The longer we wait, the closer we come to the day when Bean will die. It's a cruel and terrible fact, but when he's gone, then Peter Wiggin loses his greatest tool. Virlomi looked at him with withering scorn. Back to the battle school test scores. All the kids in battle school were tested, said Alai, including you. Yes, and what did that get any of them? They sat here in Hyderabad like passive slaves while Ashil bullied them. I escaped. Me. Somehow I was different. But did that show up on any of their tests in battle school? There are things they didn't test for. Alai did not tell her the obvious. She was different only because Petra asked her for help and not someone else. She would not have escaped without Petra's request. Ender's Jish didn't come from the tests, said Alai. We were chosen because of what we did. Because of what you did that Graf thought was important. There were qualities that he didn't know were important, so he didn't watch for them. Alai laughed. What? You're jealous because you weren't in Ender's Jish? I'm disgusted that you still believe that Bean is irresistible because he's so smart. You haven't seen him in action, said Alai. He's scary. No, you're just scared. Virlomi, said Alai, don't do this. Don't do what? Don't force my hand. I'm not forcing anything. We're equals, right? You'll tell your armies what to do, and I'll tell mine. If you send your troops on a suicide attack against China, then China will be at war with me, too. That's what our marriage means. So you're committing me to war, whether I like it or not. I can win without you. Don't believe your own propaganda, my beloved, said Alai. You aren't a god. You aren't infallible. And right now you're so irrational that it scares me. Not irrational, said Virlomi. Confident and determined. You studied where I did. You already know all the reasons why an attack against China is insane. That's why we'll achieve surprise. That's why we'll win. Besides, said Virlomi, our battle plans will be drawn up by the great Caliph Alai. And he was a member of Ender's Jish. What happened to the idea of our being equals, said Alai? We are equals. I never forced you to do anything. And I'm not forcing you, either. Saying that over and over won't make it true. I'm doing what I choose, and you're doing what you choose. The only thing I want from you is, I want your baby inside me before I lead my troops to war. What do you think this is, the Middle Ages? You don't lead your troops to war. I do, said Virlomi. You do if you're a squad commander. There's no point when you have an army of 1 million men. They can't see you, so it doesn't help. You reminded me a minute ago that you aren't Alexander of Macedon. Well, Ali, I am Jeanne d'Arc. When I said I'm not Alexander, said Ali, I wasn't referring to his military prowess. I was referring to his marriage to a Persian princess. She looked irritated. I studied his campaigns. He returned to Babylon and married a daughter of the old Persian emperor. He made his officers marry Persians, too. He was trying to unite the Greeks with the Persians and form them into one nation by making the Persians a little more Greek and the Greeks a little more Persian. Your point. The Greeks said, we conquered the world by being Greek. The Persians lost their empire by being Persian. So you aren't trying to make your Muslims more Hindu or my Hindus more Muslim. Very good. He tried to combine soldiers of Persia and soldiers of Greece into one army. It didn't work. It fell apart. We're not making those mistakes. Exactly, said Ali. I'm not going to make mistakes that destroy my caliphate. Virlomi laughed. All right, then. If you think invading China is such a mistake, what are you going to do? Divorce me? Void our treaty? What then? You'll have to retreat from India, and you'll look like even more of a Zopa. Or you'll try to stay, and then I'll go to war against you. It all comes crashing down, Ali. So you're not going to get rid of me. You're going to stay my husband, and you're going to love me, and we'll have babies together, and we'll conquer the world and govern it together. And do you know why? Why? He said sadly. Because that's how I want it. That's what I've learned over the past few years. Whatever I think of, if I decide I want it, if I do what I know I need to do, then it happens. I'm the lucky girl whose dreams come true. She came to him, wrapped her arms around him, kissed him. He kissed her back because it would be unwise of him to show her how sad and frightened he was, and how little he desired her now. I love you, she said. You're my best dream.
Chapter 20 Plans From Imperial Self, Hot Soup at ForbiddenCity.ch.gov 2 Weaver, Verlomi at motherindia.in.net, Caliph, Salam at caliph.gov, Ray, don't do this. Ali, Verlomi, what are you thinking? Troop movements can't be hidden. Do you really want this bloodbath? Are you bent on proving that Graf is right and none of us belong on Earth? Hot Soup. From Weaver, Verlomi at motherindia.in.net to Imperial Self, Hot Soup at forbiddencity.ch.gov. Ray, silly boy. Did you think that Chinese offenses in India would be forgotten? If you don't want bloodshed, then swear allegiance to Mother India and Caliph Ali. Disband your armies and offer no resistance. We will be far more merciful to the Chinese than the Chinese were to India. From Caliph, Jishman at caliph.gov to Imperial Self, Hot Soup at forbiddencity.ch.gov. Ray, look again. Take no precipitate action, my friend. Things will not go as they appear to be going.